talked to a bunch of scientists since starting Back Air Brains, and I've heard that story multiple times. Oh yeah, that's the first time I heard a spike was when I became a neuroscientist, you know, so.
Welcome to episode 28 of the Gastronauts Podcast. I am Alam Kos, and I will be your host for today's interview with Dr. Greg Gage. Dr. Gage is a neuroscientist, an electrical engineer, and the co-founder and CEO of Back Air Brains, an organization that develops open-source tools to study the brain and the nervous system. Greg is an NIH award-winning neuroscientist with 9 popular TED Talks and dozens of peer-reviewed publications, and he recently published a new book, How Your Brain Works, Neuroscience Experiments for Everyone. Well, thank you very much, Greg, for joining us. Thank you for giving us your time. And can you tell us a bit more about your work?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm a licensed electrophysiologist. So I spent my career, you know, putting wires into the brains of rodents and trying to understand how the brain works. And so my background was in basal ganglia and kind of like the cortical networks there. And so I spent years and years toiling away in my PI's lab, publishing these what I thought were high profile papers in kind of like fancy journals to understand how these cells were making choices of behaviors and stuff like that. And, you know, not once did I get an email from someone that said, "Hey, Greg, I really appreciate that work you're doing on those fast-booking inner neurons. You know, keep up the good work," you know. But then when I was in grad school with my one of my lab mates, we did something that was, well, we did it kind of as a self-imposed engineering challenge. And so we were just kind of being like hipsters and just trying to show people that that you could do things a different way. And so we made a little kit that recorded from neurons using kind of super lo-fi parts. And we presented this at the Society for Neuroscience, and we presented it in kind of a satirical way. So we were showing that you could solve the zombie problem. If your loved ones turn into zombies, it has to be a neurologic disorder, right? Because they've changed their behaviors. They walk slower or faster, depending on which movies you watch. But their appetites change, right? So they change. So maybe there's some gut neurons in there, you know? So it changed. They switch to wanting brains, right? And so, but the idea was that if it was, it has to be a neurological disorder. And so if your loved one turned into zombies and you wanted to solve that, you'd have to break into Radio Shack at night because all the vendors have turned into zombies and you couldn't buy equipment. So we had this whole story built up to kind of show a little circuit board, or it was actually just on a breadboard, of a little thing recording from a leg from a cricket, right? So we were trying to show that you could record neurons. And if we could have just had a poster that said, like, you know, a single channel bioamplifier for neuroscience education, and no one would have stopped by. But if we did it this way, we had a big crowd. And so the funny thing that happened was that there was a lady from a reporter from Nature that was there and stopped by and saw this big crowd gathered around this poster, and were asking questions about it. We got on the neuro podcast from Nature, and then all of a sudden I'm getting all these emails from people like, "Hey, I really like that project that you're doing, you know, with the little amplifier that I could use. I want to bring it into my kid's classroom and stuff like that." So like, I kept getting these emails all the time, like bing, bing. And so we realized that maybe at some point that maybe this stupid side project could be the real deal. And so that's kind of what led me into this career that I have been right now. So now I am an educator. So now I work with, designing little kits that bring electrophysiology from we started with insects, but we moved into humans and plants into the classroom to kind of bring an area of science that was completely blocked out from the classroom into something that kids can interact with. So they can record living neurons, they can do spike sorting, and they can try to figure out what do neurons encode, what information is there. So it's kind of like stuff I was doing in grad school, we could finally bring it into the classrooms and have students from like fifth grade on up be able to do, graduate level research kind of stuff. So it's kind of fun.
And these tools you developed, they allow this five graders to create advanced neuroscience hypothesis and actually test them experimentally,
It is funny is that, you know, it's a business. I'm not a really good business guy, but like the business, like listen to your customers, right? And so students have, I mean, given us so many good ideas, right? And I think it's because they don't know what they don't know. And so they're just like talk about a lot of things. And so we had a number of ideas that came from students. Even the idea, like, when I was in grad school, it was like phones had just come out, like these mobile phones and stuff. And so I was showing kids on a laptop, and they're like, "I want it on my phone." And I'm like, "Oh, wait a minute, we can do that." And so like, "Can we have that one?" You know. So we made this happen. Then what was another one? So we had a group of high school students. We made a cyborg cockroach, and this is a backpack that you put onto the back of the cockroach, and then the wires go into either antenna, right? And so we always joke that if I were God and I wanted to make the perfect brain machine interface, I would have created the cockroach. Because like if you just cut the cockroach antenna, there's like a little tube, and the tube fits perfectly with this wire that goes right in there. And so it makes this, and it pushes right up against the neurons. And so so we have this little product this little backpack that you can slide in and off, and it stimulates the antennas and it gets a behavioral response. The cockroach will turn left or right, but it adapts pretty quickly. So they will kind of learn to ignore the stimulus that's coming in and then just continue to walk to find something to hide under, right? So they still have free will at the end of the day. But the a group of high school students were trying to figure out, is there a way to make them not adapt to it? And so they were doing things like, instead of using our backpack, they're playing music into it, and they could see that this was making them sort of adapt slower. And then they did another experiment, which is even better, which we never thought of, is they put little blinders on the cockroach, and they put the backpacks on it, and they saw that when they had the blinders on, the cockroaches didn't move, like they didn't adapt as quickly because they couldn't integrate the other information that was coming in to see that there was some discrepancy, right? Brilliant idea. And we read this in the New York Times, had an article about this camp that was going on. And then we read, holy crap, it's a cool idea. And so we actually implemented the randomization function into our stimulus because maybe they're adapting to the constant stimuli.
Based on the research of these students, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of cool. So no, it's not just lip service. We are actually getting a lot of ideas from kids. So it's kind of cool.
And you do have a lot of experimental ideas. And I've seen that you published a book recently where you describe many different experimental setups.
It was all of our physiology stuff. So we had, it was called How Your Brain Works. It's kind of like an aspirational title. So I think once we published it, you know, most neuroscience lost a job because we figured it out, you know. So that book was a summary of the past decade, and it starts with all the cockroach stuff, and we're looking at all the senses, you know, like neuropharmacology. You know, we have like sense, you know, like of smells, like with using these moths that can detect their loved ones from kilometers away. It was kind of fun. So we kind of built from the core, how do neurons encode information, and then worked our way up through the human physiology. So we got into, you know, more like human physiology, EEG based stuff, and then systems based human physiology. So yeah, it's kind of fun. It was kind of a love project of like about 10 years in the making, and we've kind of condensed it all into a book that was kind of fun to finally put something down on paper. You can kind of close that part of your life on and start working on some new stuff. It's kind of exciting.
And well, students have this innate curiosity, right, about nature, about asking questions and trying to find the answers. If they can't find the answers in a book, they can go and do it now.
So the motivation of the book was for that, but it's also the idea that as scientists, I think we enter the field with this wonder and curiosity, right? And then as soon as we enter into it, and you start learning in your classes, it stops being this wonderful and curious thing to getting down. You quickly get down to the nuts and bolts, you know, like ion channels and, you know, and you start talking a completely different language than you were using before you became a scientist. And we almost forget what it was like to be curious in the same way as before, right? And so it was kind of fun coming back and re-examining it for the first time again from fresh eyes to be able to think about, wow, what we're doing is actually pretty phenomenal, right? So, yeah, it's cool.
Well, why would you say it's so important to expose kids to the scientific process?
Well, I mean, I think we have a crisis of sense-making right now in our country. We don't have a good way of discerning what's valid information from not. And I think that's what the scientific process is all about. You know, the experimental controls, figuring out, where are their sources biased, all these types of things. And I think in general in society, it's good to be teaching principles of the scientific method because it will help weed these things out. But also in general, I mean, I think we, in neuroscience in particular, I mean, we have, one out of five people, like 20% of the world has a neurological disorder with no cures. And yet they weren't teaching. I had to go and, waste 6 years of my life to get a PhD just to get access to these rigs, right? And it didn't seem make much sense given the amount of, pain and suffering that's in the world because of neurological afflictions. We don't actually teach kids about neuroscience until not even in undergrad, unless they selected a career like an undergraduate major. But most people, I went through school without learning about neuroscience at all. It wasn't until, I just happened to be, I knew I wanted to go to grad school, and I happened to be walking by a biomedical engineering lab that was doing a live recording from a rat. And I heard a spike for the first time. And that was the first time that I ever knew how the brain, I didn't even know anything about that. And it's weird that I went through almost my adult life without knowing that, right? And I think what I'd like to do is at least change that. I want to have, so we used to keep track of what's called first time spikers. So every time a kid heard a spike for the first time, we'd have this little form when people would enter it in. So we had, I haven't looked at it in a while. We had over 15,000 people heard a spike for the very first time from our stuff. And we're hoping that spark, that curiosity of that absolute wonder when you hear a neuron popping, a single cell, encoding information, that excites a lot of people. And I've talked to a bunch of scientists since starting Back Air Brains, and I've heard that story multiple times. Oh, yeah, that's the first time I heard a spike was when I became a neuroscientist, So I think exposing students at a young age to the idea, even the possibility that there's a career out there to study the brain, I think kids are generally curious about the brain. They kind of want to know how it works. And so being able to get them an idea in their head that they could actually do that, we call that self-efficacy as a neuroscientist, is important.
Yeah, that actually resonates greatly with me because I also had that first spike experience. And that's the thing that convinced me to go into neuroscience.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Because it is weird. It is because we don't sense spikes, right? We sense information. And so it just seems weird that information I always describe it as when I show a spike on the screen, we have, it's like an oscilloscope app. And so it's like this black screen with this green line with all these things on it. And it reminds me of the movie The Matrix, when you saw that green code, you're like, oh my God, that's reality.
That's what the world is.
Yeah. And you're looking at, this is like the, it's like, this is reality. Your reality really is these things that we talk about in science, like the action potentials of the rate coding, all these neurotransmitters, but we don't perceive it that way. We perceive it as reality, right? We perceive it as these information. And so it's kind of cool seeing that transition in kids' minds when they get blown away by that. And it's absolutely fascinating. I'm still fascinated by it.
It's different to see this graph in a book, right? Showing the action potential, see the histogram of it going up, going faster than listening to it.
Yeah, no, I always there's some pictures of famous electrophysiologists. They always have headphones down here because they're kind of like they're always up there. And so, when I was in grad school, I had some recordings from neurons that I would do with my tetrodes. And I would put them on my little iPod and I would listen to them and go to sleep. And it's just such a beautiful sound, especially when you're approaching a neuron. Yeah, it's kind of cool. So. Yeah.
And how was your trip from engineering into neuroscience? Was it an easy transition for you?
Yeah, it was. It was a weird one. So I had worked for a number of years in industry. So I was actually down here in the South. So I had my first job was in South Carolina doing engineering for AT&T. And I was working, my first PCB was like a little touchscreen for somebody. And so I got skills on how to communicate from chipsets to chipsets. And so how do you do that type of stuff? And so then when I did that for about 10 years, I remember my shock and horror. I was in a review and my boss told me, hey, Greg, you don't want to be carrying around a toolbox the rest of your life. You really need to get into management because like it's time to grow up. And I kept thinking like after that, I had a really yucky feeling. I'm like, there's got to be a career where you could be a geek and you get rewarded for it, right? And I was trying to think, and it took me about a year of like soul searching and figuring out like when was I last like really happy? And I was like, well, I was really happy when I was an undergrad, kind of doing research projects, stuff like that. And I was like, maybe academia could be it. So I went home for Christmas break. I was living in the Netherlands at the time, so I came home for Christmas break, and I went to campus, and that's where I had that experience of just walking. And I wanted to be a biomedical engineer because I figured that's close enough to what I wanted to do. I mean, it's kind of interesting. Human physiology is kind of interesting, but I had no idea, but even about neuroscience at that time, I was just going by different labs. And I came across this EFIS lab called the Neuroengineering Lab at the University of Michigan. And I heard that neuron for the first time. And I realized that I could actually, like this electrical signal is very similar to what I've been studying, right? I've been using electrical signal for communication on chips. And it's like, so I felt a little bit more comfortable getting into that program because it was kind of close to where I was. And so, yeah, I jumped in and I joined. It was an engineering lab. So it was like, it was biomedical engineering, so neuroengineering. So looking at brain machine interfaces and this type of stuff. So I got, it was a pretty natural fit. But and then when I was there, I realized I was more curious about not so much the engineering aspects, but about the neuroscience aspects. And so I switched to another lab that was doing this kind of just pure science and research based on the basal ganglia. So that, and then my career turned, I had completely planned to go into, the postdoc and then, get a young faculty position and then try to get tenure and then move to another spot, have it all. I had a whole roadmap laid out. And then this weird thing happened, that, which I mentioned about this this Nature podcast. And then all of a sudden this opportunity showed up. And I felt that it was going to do it as a non-traditional postdoc, right? And then we wrote an NIH grant that got funded. And I was, holy shit, man, this could be a non-traditional career. And I feel like I short-circuited about, maybe 6 or 7 years of my career just by jumping right into becoming a PI and being able to hire people and start doing experiments and start producing it. And so, yeah, it's a different career path than most people have. So I have a company and the company sells products and the products that we sell help fund, the research. But we're not really good business people, or I'm not at least. And so we haven't been able to completely cover all of our R&D costs for doing experiments. We still write research grants in the form of what's called SBIR, Small Business Innovative Research Grants, that are just like R1s. You write them to the NIH and they get reviewed and stuff like that. So that's what's been kind of funding about 30 to 40% of what I do, and the rest come from sales. And I'm hoping that if I was smart, I would just focus on the sales for like a while and then I wouldn't have to write grants anymore. But I don't know, I kind of like writing grants. I guess I'm a masochist that way. So
yeah, the money has to come from somewhere.
Yeah,
right? Speaking of brain machine interfaces, a lot has been said about brain machine interfaces and how in the near future we may be using them to control our smartphones or house appliances, right? Our vehicles, playing video games. How do you envision the future of brain-machine interfaces? Do you think we will ever truly integrate them in our day-to-day lives?
Well, I'll say a few things. The first thing I'll say is that the non-invasive stuff, probably not, right? There's a lot of information transfer that can be done. But with EEG, like these headsets that you put on, no. We're not going to get much information out of those things. So with the electromyogram, the output from the motor cortex that you can, people splay muscles apart and be able to control individual fiber bundles, the information transfer from that starts to increase, right? So you can control kind of gross movements of prosthetic arms. But I think to really get to something that you're talking about, controlling smartphones and doing things that are interesting, we need to talk to the neurons a little bit more closely, right? So we need to be integrated more inside the cortex, probably. And there's a couple of ideas that are floating around. These nanofibers that can kind of pass through pretty easily from the skull. But these all seem kind of a bit dangerous. But maybe at some point, and this is what Elon Musk is doing with his Neuralink, trying to bring this idea of just pushing it in there. And I'm wondering, it's a very curious question, right? Can you interface directly with the brain? I do believe that if we have stimulation, two-way pathways, that you might be able to form networks that you can control things. But it's the Wild West. I have no idea. I mean, I do believe in like models of consciousness that have information theory as its core, you know, like the attention schema theory, which is this idea that you build up models, and one of your models is of your own attention. But you're trying to sort of take all this information and sort it out in a certain way so that you can manipulate and predict what the future is going to be, right? And so if there were extra sources of information that would help do that, I do believe that we could probably integrate that into our consciousness, and so we can be able to do this. But it's an engineering challenge, I think, at first. And I think that engineering challenge, I haven't seen many solutions that would allow for this to occur. But, you know, we're in 2023. So it's early days, right? So who knows, in 100 years, people will listen to this podcast and they go, this guy was absolutely wrong, right? So it does seem that from where I'm sitting, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard unless we have a new form of, maybe like with AI, they solve action at a distance, so they're able to do something external from the brain that can then either see in and see the electrical impulses, or see maybe mechanical vibrations of act potentials or something, they'd be able to record from the brain and then maybe be able to stimulate back in. So who knows, there could be ways to do that non-invasively in the future that will be completely different than we have right now. But yeah, I'm not too concerned. I'm not too concerned about someone reading my thoughts anytime in the near future.
Yeah, and these future researchers will be inspired by the things that you do. That's
yeah, and it's funny. We do a lot with brain machine interfaces in our work. So it's like the electromyogram, the output from the motor cortex, is like one synapse away to your muscles, right? So we can record for the muscles and have machines do stuff. And I think that in itself is kind of awe-inspiring for people. They can't believe, and especially when you stimulate a nerve and you get something to move, and you connect the two together, one person moves and that EMG goes into another person, it causes them to move. And so like, that is kind of like, we're almost there, right? You know, it's a bit of a parlor trick, but it's enough to get people excited about it. And I think it could be. I sound pretty pessimistic about it because I know too much about it, right? But that's why you need students that don't know too much about it, because they're going to forget everything I just said and they're going to keep trying to do it, right?
Do something new, right?
Yeah, do something new. That's like we got to get these old people like me out of the way so that the young people come in and actually solve the problems that I'm saying, that I'm naysaying.
Pretty amazing. And what makes you excited about going to work every day?
Yeah, so lately, it's funny because I've been struggling, because as I was saying, like that book was good because it kind of closes out a portion of my career. And now what I'm excited about is more on the computational side, like the computational, because I feel like how we're going to solve the brain will be not through more data. I think we have enough data, right? I think we need our better models about how the brain works. And so as my role, I'm kind of like a person that works closely with teachers in the classrooms. I'm trying to figure out ways to take computational neuroscience and make that as accessible as we've been doing with electrophysiology. And so we have a couple of new projects that I'm super excited about. One of them it's called the Neural Robot. We call it the Spiker Bot. And it's a little robot that has a camera for an eye, and then instead of like using OpenCV and all these other ways, like an error in a deep neural network to figure out what's going on, is that when a motion comes by, we have a little neuron that just spikes. And then these are little computational neurons running Isakiewicz neurons. And so we have a little spiking neuron, and then a student on a little app can draw a synapse between that and, for example, a motor neuron. And when a motor neuron gets a spike, it will turn the motor just a little bit, right? And so then if you get a lot of spikes, the motor turns a lot. And if you don't have spikes, it doesn't move at all. And so we have this ability to, with four neurons, you can have, you cross over with excitement and then you go straight down with inhibitories. And with just those four neurons, you can get a robot to follow you around the room because it's going to excite the side that the camera is not on and inhibit the side that you're on. So therefore, the robot turns. And when they both are looking at you, it just goes forwards. So then we're trying to show how do you take a spiking neural network, which is our brain, and turn it into behaviors, right? Because that's what we're doing. It's kind of weird to think about that we are spiking neural networks, right? So if you add another neuron, for example, that's onto the ear, a little microphone, and you inhibit everything until you whistle, and then it unlocks. And so you can have like a dog, and then the robot will come towards you and will follow you around. So you can do this. You can just add complexity by adding another neuron in there. So that's one of the things that I'm excited about because it's the researcher that brought in the idea to us is he was a zebrafish modeler. He was trying to model the brain of zebrafish and the tectum and how do you attend to different things. And so the idea of if we really understand how the brain works, we should be able to build a robot that has those similar behaviors as an animal, right? So that's how he got into it and then kind of brought that idea to us. And we've been absolutely loving it because now we're able to do the things that I find exciting, which is like bringing back into behavior, the neural systems of behaviors, right? So it's kind of cool. And then we have another interesting project that's looking at how do neurons work, right? So the ion channels within them. And so we're making a little neuron that you can touch. And then we have these little knobs, and it's going to solve the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, right? So you can have sodium channels and potassium channels and, calcium-activated potassium channels. And so, you can have these different things. You can find out, if you eat a pufferfish and you get numb, what's happening. So you're like, all right, well, I'm going to turn down the sodium channel. And all of a sudden, hey, this neuron's not firing anymore. And, the students can know, that's probably why that's why it feels numb. There's no information coming in. So, we're kind of trying to come up with, using computational models to explain a little bit more how the brain works. And that's kind of where I'm interested in right now. And I think that this AI stuff is absolutely blowing. I mean, it's and I feel that, I've been in computational neuroscience, which I've been in for the past 12 years. I've had a front row seat of watching this stuff grow, and it's been super exciting seeing all the work that's been done in that field. It'd be kind of cool to sort of bring that into the classroom and get sort of kids thinking about maybe not even the stuff not these transformer models or CNNs, but more about how do neural networks actually work so that they can come up with better ways. For example, it'd be cool if we didn't have to, spend a year and a half training, GPT-3 on data. Wouldn't it be cool if we could just, if we add something new that we just update the network? I mean, the brain doesn't take we don't close our eyes for a year and a half. And then now I know things, right? So we're constantly, behaving and learning at the same time, whereas the networks don't do that right now. So we got to go, if we get students to think more about how do neurons actually work, maybe they have a completely different model of how these artificial neural networks should work. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, and everyone's right now talking about AI, right? How it's going to change the world.
Yeah, it's going to change the world.
But understanding artificial intelligence leads people to wonder, well, if this is artificial intelligence, what is a natural intelligence like, right?
Right,
so how does it work? How can you make spikes in neurons actually move something, create behavior, right?
Yeah, and it gets to the, and then I feel like the next big thing in hardware are going to be moving more to these neuromorphic computers, right? So having more and more sort of real world examples of how this is basically neuromorphic hardware done in simulation, right? So we have neurons that are we're just computing every time step of what the voltage would be, but it'd be cool just Intel has the Curie chip. So they have there's a bunch of people that are working on these kind of neuromorphic hardware. Then you just put them on there and actually have the physical hardware be representing our brains. And I think that is super low. It's super efficient. And you can do these cool trainings and update them in real time, like the brain does. And so I think there's a big field for that in the future. And I think it's cool to be kind of in the early stages of that.
How do you see these new technologies eventually altering the design of your systems or the tools that you're using?
Yeah, so I'd love to see in the future. Right now, we're kind of limited to the amount of processing we can do for how many neurons. And so even on an Arduino, like a little cheap microprocessor, we can do about, you know, between 10 and 100 neurons. But I think to get to the brain, right, you need a lot more neurons than that. So I think you could do it on a big rack of, you know, servers to be able to do that. Or you can push it into a chipset that actually emulates in hardware the voltage levels of neurons. And I think that would be super efficient, right? So I think it'd be cool to see, like, in the future that we switch over from simulation of neurons to actually running the electrical voltages of neurons on a chip and have these things actually do amazing stuff, you know, like that these, you know, these convolutional neural networks and stuff we're doing right now. It was kind of exciting.
And is there any advice that you'd like to give students who may be considering going into neuroscience as a career, or more specifically, engineering students that may want to
do? Yeah, no, I think it's, right. I always say when students ask, hey, how do I get into neuroscience? I never tell them do a neuroscience undergraduate, right? Because I always say do an engineering, you know, do a chemistry, you know, do one of the hard sciences. Because I feel like once you understand a little bit aspects of, especially within engineering, I think engineers and physicists make really good neuroscientists, that once you understand a little bit more about how engineering principles are, you start to understand systems better, and the brain is a system, right? So I think that's one of the things I'd say. To my scientific colleagues, I would say, let's not take ourselves too seriously, because I feel we have we kind of fall into that trap sometimes. And I think that's, at least in my career, it's been quite helpful not to be too serious, because I think it's been, it sort of lets down some guards that are normally up in science and allows you to have a bit more interactions that are where ideas get passed more freely, I would say. So that's my advice I would have for young students trying to get into science and scientists that are already out there.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for having me here. I'm looking forward to my rest of the day on campus. Cheers.
Thank you so much. As Dr. Gage pointed out, the brain, complex as it may be, is in the end a system that we can observe, measure, and understand if we have the right tools for it. And if we don't have them, well, let's create them. Thank you for listening to episode 28 of the Gastronauts podcast. Meredith Schmel is our music composer, and we'd like to thank everyone in the Wohorkes Lab. See you next month.